Welcome to Life and Love in the Q, a podcast for the LGBTQIA2S+ community, those who support them, and those who just want to learn more.
Together we share the stories and the science of the space and grace to live life in full color.
I'm Jillian Abbey, proud lesbian and mother, Hay House author, queer blogger, and TikTok something or other.
And I'm Trisha Peterson. I'm an LGBTQ ally, proud mom of six, professor and researcher of identity and the social narratives that impact the way we live and love.
So open your mind, open your heart, and welcome to Life and Love in the Q.
Hello, Jill. I am so glad to be back for episode 2 of your story.
Thank you. This time I've put on my hiking boots and my climbing gear as we climb the summit of Supposed to Mountain and other things.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I want to start off though, because I cut you off as you were starting to tell us a story about you and your mom and a yearbook.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about compulsory heterosexuality. So I want to say, what else do you want us to know about that? And then tell us the story of the freaking yearbook.
Yeah, well, so kind of we were talking about how compulsory heterosexuality is the expectation that you are heterosexual, or raising people to be as if all people are heterosexual. And we know that's not the truth. Obviously, there are queer people out there, trans people out there who have always existed. But the story of the yearbook is interesting because, you know, when we say compulsory heterosexuality, it's easy to pin a really negative connotation to it. And so I wanted to share a story from my book where there was not a negative intention necessarily behind it, but it is an example of one way that compulsory heterosexuality, I'm just saying comp het from now on because I'm tripping on my words, how it did present my life. And so I was in high school and my mom and I were very close. She realized that I didn't really have any boyfriends. I didn't really seem to be showing a whole lot of interest in boys at that point. So she brought out my yearbook and we sat on the carpet of our living room and she went through picture by picture of the guys in my yearbook and said, "What about him? What about him? What about him?" And I had to come up with a different excuse for every single guy of like, here's why I don't want to date him. Here's why I don't want to date him. And, you know, it's kind of funny now because my mom and I just had a conversation yesterday actually about that memory and that part of my book. And she said, "I can't believe that I did that. Like, how did I not realize what I was doing?" But the thing is, there's a lot of people who are not familiar with the term comp het. And if we don't talk about it, we don't realize how it presents in our life, then we don't always realize that we're doing it or that we're laying a certain expectation of who we want our children to be or who we want our friends to be or other people in our lives. But the other thing that was funny to me too, is she said, "Well, you were probably looking at the pictures of the girls while I was pointing to the guys and thinking like, well, no, it would rather be her." And the funny thing is I wasn't at that point. I actually was thinking that maybe I was asexual at that point because I, in my mind, and the way I had been raised, I only saw it as you can be attracted to guys or you become a nun. Like you're just not attracted to anyone. I do not know why my brain could not make the connection that even though I had feelings for girls or I found myself attracted to girls, like having a relationship with them was not even a thing that happened on this earth. I saw gay guys. I did see lesbians. Didn't realize it was a thing, which is still so funny to me in hindsight. But
well, I think so. One of the things I want to share with our listeners that might be on the mom side, right? Like, so you're able to look back from your perspective and have that memory. And I think I've shared this with you before, but for me, I had a stick figure family that I had put up on my vision board.
Mm.
And I had, it said, "My eternal family," and it was made of these cute little stick figures. And I had every one of my children partnered with a member of the opposite sex. And then there were babies intermingled, and there was a couple of little families that I put a kitty with or a puppy with, or, you know, just I had the stickers. Like it was as innocent as me with stickers and creating a vision board of like my vision that eventually my children would grow up and they would get married and they might have children and they might get pets and they would work and have jobs and we would all be this really close-knit, happy family. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was a fun little way of a portrait of a happy family. But when my kids were, when my first son came out as gay, I looked up at that and I saw, and I thought, he has been looking at that vision of what I think is the ideal family for at least 5 to 6 years. And he's actually not up there because I have the sixth child in this vision partnered with a female. And his vision of his happy married after is him partnered with a man. Yeah. And that was like my first, really my first realization as a mom as to how I was even infusing that compulsory heterosexuality into my home.
Yeah.
So, and I'm with your mom. Holy cow. I didn't, never in a million years was my intention to shame him
or teach him
that he was unlovable.
Right.
But I created a vision that my son could not see himself in.
Mm. Well, and that's the thing too, is I think comp het comes up in so many different ways. And one other example I can think from the book is I talk about playing the game, the board game Life with my kids.
Oh, yeah.
And the first stop in life is marriage. And so now for us, it's become a talking point of like, also marriage is not compulsory. You don't have to get married if you don't want to. But if you do, if you're a blue peg, you don't have to put the pink peg in the car. Or if you're the pink peg, you don't have to put the blue peg in the car. It is funny though, that when I was playing and my partner, Jen, was playing with us as well. And so she got to the marriage stop and she put a dog in the car. And I was like, Jen, what? I'm offended now. Okay. She's like, what? I thought we could do whatever we wanted. I was like, okay, fine. I see where I rank. But anyways, but the game of life is just one other example. Mm-hmm. There's just the expectation that you're going to get married and that when you reach that marriage stop, you put in the peg of the opposite color. And so it's interesting to me because, again, like, I don't think anyone who designed the game Life was like, this is how we'll keep them all straight. Like, there wasn't any like agenda or bad thoughts behind it. It's just kind of the expectation for what we think most people will do. But it really doesn't capture a portion of our society. I mean,
very large portion.
Right. Like the most recent Gallup poll, 20% of Gen Z population, so aged 19 to 26, identifies non-heterosexual. And even among millennials, which is my category, even though I still kind of, so it's 27-year-olds to 42-year-olds, 11.2% identify as not heterosexual. And that number has doubled since 2012. So just in 10 years, the number of millennials who are identifying as LGBTQ has doubled. And I think that speaks to the fact that there are just so many people out there who have had this comp het idea kind of slathered on them their whole life and are now realizing, now that we do have more queer visibility and more support, that there are other options and they're starting to see themselves in those options.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So interesting. And it, so one of the things that I want to talk about then, or ask you about, as I'm, so I know a little bit about you and your mom's story. Your mom has quite an appearance in the book in a couple of different places. And I kind of want to clarify or maybe identify that's probably very normal because mothers have quite a visibility into the upbringing of their children. And I do recognize that by saying that, I am also subscribing to kind of a compulsory heterosexual mindset in that traditional stereotypical roles say that the mother is the one who raises the children, the father is the one who provides for the children. So I totally understand that in everything that I'm saying, I am subscribing to the narrative. Mm-hmm. But also I am acknowledging that it is the narrative that right. we currently live with. So your mom, it makes sense why your mom has quite a role in your book. But one of the things that as we move kind of towards that concept that we talked about in the last episode a little bit, but that supposed to mountain, so much of that supposed to mountain is built by our parents and our community, especially if we have a community that is really intertwined with the values and the expectations and the beliefs that we subscribe to. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. Have you share a little bit maybe about kind of even your, what you were absorbing as your mom's hopes for you, your mom's dreams for you. So like I just shared the story of the stick figure. Mm-hmm. I was definitely painting for my children this picture of, I hope you grow up. I hope you go on a mission. I hope you get married in the LDS temple. I hope that you marry a partner who loves you. I hope that you get to be a stay-at-home mom if you're a girl, and that you get to be the provider. Like I was creating this vision of my children's lives because it fit the norm and the standard. I was creating a supposed to mountain for them without ever actually saying, what do you want?
Yeah. I don't think you're the only one, Tricia.
I don't think I am, but I sure beat myself up as if I am. I will be honest.
Yeah. And I honestly, like just even you saying that, I think that's why it just goes back to the importance of sharing our stories, because then we recognize that this is a thing. We are not alone, like that this is out there and it's a regular thing. I kick off my book. The first chapter is called Star Baby because
I love this. All right.
Yeah, because so my mom, when I was little, she used to call me Star Baby. That was one of my nicknames. We talked about when I was older and got my first car that like we would put Star Baby on the vanity plate of the car. And she never knew what I would be known for, like what would exactly make me Star Baby. The fact that it's lesbian memoirist, I'm sure was never on her radar as far as things like that. But I talk in the book too about how much love I had for my mom and how much I just wanted to make her proud, and how I recognized the things that she had sacrificed in her own life or things that she didn't get to do in her own life that now I wanted to do in my life as, I don't know, almost like as an act of love or so that she would feel proud. And so one of those things was like, you know, she was a younger mom. She was in college and then dropped out and married my dad, who also didn't finish college. They had me, and they both worked in jobs that, you know, helped pay the bills, but were not dream jobs or were not like satisfying in any way. And so there was always a big hope placed on me that I would go to college and finish, and that it would be from a great university, and then that I would go get a corporate job because, you know, those are the ones that had prestige and the great paychecks. And so those were my supposed to mountains. These are things that maybe my mom wanted or that my parents hoped for me because they're things that they didn't get in their own life. And so I want to make sure that I am making them proud. And I think that's really what drove me in a lot of what I did. And I don't say that to put it on them. Like, well, we all hope for the best for our children. But I think sometimes what our thoughts of the best are is different. So for some people, the best is a full bank account or that perfect stick figure family. And then to your point, maybe the best is asking them what they want. Or just giving them the space to grow into who they are. Maybe, is that the best? I don't know.
I can never remember her last name, but her name is Dr. Shefali Tosberry, maybe. I'm not sure. But she talks about, as parents, so many parents say that they want their children to be healthy and happy. Mm-hmm. But when we define healthy and happy, everybody's definition of what it means to be healthy and happy is completely different. So even just those two visions for our children, they seem so innocent and they seem so like, of course, everybody wants their children to be healthy and happy, right? But we can't actually choose happiness for anybody.
Yeah.
And what makes you happy may make me incredibly, like, I can't even imagine myself in karate. Like my poor brain, I've thought of it a couple of times and I can't imagine it. Yeah. But put me on a yoga mat and I feel so at home and at peace. That doesn't mean that karate isn't a path to happiness for anybody, because it's a path to happiness that you've found. Or was it Tai Chi?
Yeah. Taekwondo.
Taekwondo.
Yeah.
So you found a wonderful path to happiness. via that road to me, it might have given me a lot of headaches. So we don't get to define that for anybody, but yet as parents, we try to a lot.
What you just said is so fascinating to me too, the concept of wanting our children to be healthy and happy, because also I think you're right that sometimes we don't, there's almost condition to that though sometimes as well. Because if I look back on my coming out process, coming out, living what I felt was true to me and as I actually am, like that is my happiness. This is where my light inside has grown so big and I feel so full and so loved. And then even in terms of health, when I was masking, when I knew, when I suspected that I may be queer and was masking it and still trying to maintain that ideal life, it took a real toll on my mental health.
Yes.
And so coming out was actually a huge act of improving my own health mentally, and that it also affects my physical health, but it wasn't seen that way at the time. A lot of people saw my coming out as being a destructive act, when in fact, that was my happy, healthy.
So
eventually.
Well, not just eventually though, because I want to go back to our first episode. That's why I asked, that's why I actually interrupted this whole conversation, because the thing that allowed you to do that was you had felt a spark within you a couple of times before. Yes. So you knew there was something deeper in you that was something you weren't feeling on the climb to supposed to mountain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the powerful thing. And again, I'm going to come at it from that perspective of the outside other. So you're coming at it from the inside self. Mm-hmm. As I look at it, even for my own children, there were a couple of things that I had. My oldest daughter, I could see how miserable she was getting going to church. I could see it. Her demeanor changed. Mm-hmm. Every time we walked in, she followed supposed to mountain to a T.
Right. And there's a lot of good climbers out there.
Yeah. Oh my heck. And this particular one of my child, her children, she had the right boots on. She did everything right. And she climbed that stupid mountain 30 or 40 times before she was tired of the mask. And in her situation, she had to take a good solid 6 to 9 months break from me. Mm. And mom, I'm putting a pause on our relationship because I've got some things to figure out. And I think as a parent, the reality is I saw the signs that she was masking, mm-hmm. but I too was holding true to the fact of if we both just work a little harder, if we do a little more, then we can reach happy on this mountain. But sometimes happy doesn't exist. There is no happy flag on supposed to mountain.
I love that. I mean, I've got a bumper sticker. People will be like, I don't know what the hell that means, but there is no happy flag on the top of supposed to mountain.
There isn't. Cause we get to the top and we look around and we're like, this is not my peak.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And that was, so going through the audiobook and kind of reliving this whole climb over and over again, that is another thread that kept popping up of me checking all the boxes, doing everything that I thought I was supposed to, and then saying, if this is it, like if this is living, why do we live? Because I feel so empty.
I think you just explained perfection. Mm. I think that what you just said is exactly why perfectionism feels so hollow and empty.
Yeah.
Because exactly what you said, we start living our life according to somebody else's standards, somebody else's hopes, somebody else's dreams. And we get to the top, damn it, we climbed hard. We did our best. Mm-hmm. We did better than our best, likely, because we didn't want to be there. So we were fighting our own, like we were fighting our own dreams that were calling us to get to the top of somebody else's mountain. We get to the top and we're like, why does anybody want to be here?
Yeah.
I think that's the shallow experience of perfectionism.
Yeah, it was which really also, hard.
Which also is all throughout your book. Perfectionism is just like you right. vomited perfection all over your life.
Oh, I sure. I mean, that's why it's part of the title too. It's not, there's, I love that in the last episode, you talked about kind of the beauty in pairing perfectly and queer together. Because this is my love letter to the queer community and kind of bringing a light to the queer identity. But also there is so much perfectionism in this story. And even, and I think this is something that I hear a lot from other people, and especially women who are coming out later in life, is how much they still question, like, they know they're gay and they're still like, but maybe I'm not. Like, maybe if I just try harder.
Maybe I'm wrong about my own hopes, dreams, and desires.
Yes. Actually, there's a section from the book where I say the annoying perfectionist troll in my mind would keep me occupied by saying things like, ew, you're not really going to give up all of this just to other yourself in society. Maybe you're not really sexually attracted to women. Maybe you could just be broken. Maybe that is your truth. And I wrote, I didn't find the mind troll to be particularly witty or intelligent, but boy, was she persistent. Because it was this constant conversation with myself of anything but gay, just anything but gay. And really kind of the underlying other piece to that is because I had some internalized homophobia. And so internalized homophobia, it was a bias I had against queerness. Mm. And so for me, being perfect, there was no such thing as being perfectly queer. Heterosexuality,
the brokenness.
Exactly. Heterosexuality was the perfect. And so I didn't see how I could live up to my perfectionist ideals and be a queer person.
Well, and so I kind of want to go back again to the whole concept of the compulsory heterosexuality, is because I can see, I understand why people might have a hard time with the phrase. And I can see it from a lot of different perspectives. But really what it is we have created an ideology, a social ideal. And we can go into any preschool class and we can ask a child what family life is going to look like for them when they grow up. And they're all going to be able to paint us a very, very similar picture because they've seen it narrated or they've heard it narrated. They've seen it illustrated. They've watched it animated. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere that they've looked. And that's the compulsory part of it, is it's just so ingrained into the fabric of our lives that we can't see anything but the narrative.
Yeah.
Can you think of anybody else that was painting what those hopes and dreams? I know that we've talked a little bit about this with you and your ex-husband, that there was just kind of a step in line of, well, we just followed the next thing, you know, the next grown-up decision is marriage. The next grown-up decision is children.
Yeah. Again, that was a really hard part for me because I did have so much love for him and we did enjoy being together. And that's the thing, is there was so much goodness still. Mm. And from the way our life looked, everything was so good that I thought, well, I guess I have to be doing things the right way because it's not bad, but it still, just because it was good, didn't mean it was the right kind of good for me. So I think that's kind of the biggest takeaway. And I think that's, again, that was one of those reasons why I wanted to tell my story, is I think we hear sometimes about, you know, well, our marriage was broken, or, you know, it, I don't know. We don't, there's not necessarily a lot of times where we hear stories of like, it was good. We had a good relationship. And yet even still, it wasn't the right thing. And I had to step away. And I, you know, I kind of cringed when I was reading the audiobook because there's a section, but it's true. And this is why it's in the book. There were times where I almost wish that our relationship wasn't as good. Like there were times I wished he had cheated on me or gambled away our living or some reason so that I could validate why we had to end our marriage, because my queerness, I questioned if that was a valid reason, but I had other people question me as well of like, okay, fine. So you're a lesbian. Why do you have to get divorced? And I'm like, because I'm a lesbian. But it did cause me to question myself too, of like, what is good and what we're supposed to do is so strong that going against the current of that is really a battle. And I think that's kind of the point of the book too, is that coming out is not easy. It's not just saying, oh, I'm gay. There's so many layers to it.
Yeah.
So much of a mental process, so much of a social process. there's just a lot to it. It's not easy. And so for anyone who's going through the process, I hope that the book is kind of a hug of comfort and support for them, that what they're feeling is not so strange or weird or unusual. And then for anyone who is trying to support a person in their coming out process, for them to understand why it's not just, okay, I'm gay and now I do this.
Well, I think one of the things that I loved about your book is, so there's this kind of, not kind of, there's this narrative that says that gayness is a choice.
Oh, yeah.
And that it's just a choice people are making.
Yeah.
Or it's a trendy thing, or, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like it's the trend of the day.
Yeah.
But the thing that I feel like your book really, really shows is there was no way that it was a choice that you are making. You fought this like there was no tomorrow.
And
you
I sure did.
Time and time again. I loved the book because I love you, but I also loved the book because it really made me gut check my own parenting and my own relationship with people. I already try really hard not to put people in a box and judge people, but I have to make, that's something I have to consciously be aware of, making sure that I help people break down any brick walls that they've formed around themselves. Is just really important to me. And your book to me was just that reminder, like, who in my life is struggling to get out of their brick wall.
Yeah. Well, and thank goodness for the people who are safe spaces out there. I mean, we've talked about this time and time again on the podcast, like why allyship is so important, and not just being a quiet ally, but any sort of signaling that you are okay, that you're an okay space for another person to share their story is so important. Because yeah, I built a pretty freaking thick brick wall around myself to keep that part of myself hidden. It was community. It was having people that I knew would love and support me. That's the only way I would have made it to the other side.
Yeah.
It's like coming out is not a solo journey.
No, but honestly, neither is staying in. So that's
right.
That is so frustrating. I think that's what people, I do think there's a lot of people in the world that just think, then just stay in your closet.
Yeah.
Like if it's so hard on you to come out of the closet, mm-hmm. then stay in your closet. But that's the thing, is it's being in the closet is also not, it's not somewhere that we can stay alone. Well,
Maybe we wrap there. Are you holding the closet door shut, or are you helping to open it up for someone else?
Or even just standing at the door with the light on. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes to me, when I've been in my darkest moments, I don't even want to open the door, but just knowing that somebody's got the flashlight, that they're poking the flashlight underneath yes. the door so I can't bury myself.
Right.
It's critical.
Yeah. And if they have snacks, that's a bonus. So bring your flashlight, bring your snacks on our next edition of Girl Scouts Coming Out Edition.
All right. Well, this was a great conversation. I can't wait to continue for part 3.
Yeah, same. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, US podcast listeners, we want to come to you. If you're interested in having a perfectly queer book event with me, Jillian Abbey, and Dr. Trisha, email us at lifeandloveinthequeue@gmail.com or DM us on our social media accounts and let us know where you're at in the US. We would love to coordinate and connect with you to meet you in person, and we appreciate your support. Thank you for listening to Life and Love in the Queue. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share. And if you have questions, contact us at lifeandloveinthequeue@gmail.com. Until next time, Q Crew.